Mouse Audio Podcast Network. Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
This is Herstory, smash patriarchy like pumpkin pie. This is Herstory, everyone scream liberty, laws off my body, you'll be in for a fight. Badass babes, you didn't know, buckle up for this drunk ass show. Everybody scream, for Kelly and Emily. Everybody scream, for whining about Herstory.
If you had the tune tell. Perfectly.
Thank you very much.
That was beautiful. I was in awe over here.
I typed that up in less than a minute.
Wow. I'm impressed.
It was a lot. Think I've seen Nightmare Before Christmas a billion times. But welcome.
Now I really want to watch it.
I know. Dude, okay, can I just say, really quick before we even introduce who we are or what this is, Nightmare Before Christmas scared the crap out of me when I was really little. Oogie Boogie.
Is terrifying.
Could not fucking deal. So even though I love that movie and watch as an adult, there are still parts where I like get that like the inner child in me is like, oh,
yeah.
Like, you know, yeah. There's like some of the characters I'm still like, oh, I don't like need to look at you for an extended period of time. But welcome to Whining About Herstory, the Women's History Podcast. We're two besties with breasties whining about women from history that you probably haven't heard of, but definitely should have.
Seriously.
And this month, being spooky October, month. It's spooky, it's ooky, it's altogether kooky. We are whining about femme fatales, the bad ladies.
People who should not
the
emulate.
Ladies on the dark side of Herstory. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And thank you for joining us. This is where we kind of moonlight as a true crime podcast for half a month.
We get to embrace our other love.
So Kelly and I both, for anyone who hasn't been listening to us for 3 years, which don't blame you, who doesn't know.
Seriously,
Kelly
I cap it too. And then I just stopped paying attention.
Kelly, you haven't listened to a single one of our episodes, okay?
Don't
you fucking
pretend. I've listened to like two of them.
Shut up. Anyway, Kelly and I both like really enjoyed true crime podcasts. And before we decided to do a women's history podcast, we thought about doing true crime. But one, there are so many good ones and we just really didn't feel like, well, we just really didn't feel like we had a ton to add. But the main thing, mentally, to read about horrible things happening to people every day, like truly the worst things imaginable, it's a lot. Like sometimes, like I've cried researching some of the stories. I've cried telling some of these stories because they just really break my heart. I can't imagine covering those kinds of stories every week. Yeah. But this month we're going to do it. But we're not covering victims or survivors for the most part. I have a survivor story I might tell. We'll see. It'll be a surprise, fun little spooky surprise. But we are covering women on the darker side of Herstory, women you may not want to emulate, women who are on the wrong side of the law, whether or not they should have been. Like I covered a madam who was kind of a fucking badass, the Minneapolis madam.
I'm trying to think if I covered the two gangster leaders from Australia during October.
Didn't cover them during October.
But I have covered them.
But you did cover them. And then I did like the White Elephant Gang, which are, you know, they're the ladies that made it so none of us can have pockets because they use their pockets for evil.
I mean, don't we all?
Okay, men use their pockets for way more evil than we do. Come on. Come on.
Should we jump into our spoopiness?
We should. So what are we drinking today, Kelly?
Ooh, yes, we are drinking.
And we are drinking the depths of spookiness.
We are drinking the Juggernaut Hillside Cab Sauv.
I thought you were going to say the Juggernaut Hillside Stranglers. And I'm like, that's
funny.
Too much.
It has a very, very pretty, very intense like lion on the front.
This wine is incredible. So we try to drink spooky themed wines during October, and the label
this is
of this
spookiest wine I have.
It's also incredibly violent. Like yeah. This lion, it's like the Savo lion. It will wreck your shit.
So apparently juggernaut is actually a type of grape. So it says juggernaut grapes are grown in challenging conditions where true grit and determination yield spectacular results. Determined hillside Cabernet vines struggle to find purchase on steep, rocky slopes where well-draining soil inspires roots to burrow deep in search of life-sustaining moisture. Steadfast Pinot Noir vines endure unwavering and inhospitable conditions, battered by wind and fog, struggling to utilize every precious hour of warmth and sunlight over a long growing season. Juggernaut wines harness the power of nature to produce robust, compelling wines as expressive and powerful as the alpha predators adorning our labels. So they only make two kinds of wine. They make a Cab Sauv and a Pinot Noir. That's why they talk about both grapes.
Okay.
So specifically the Cab Sauv says, French oak beautifully transforms intense hillside fruit into a wine with uncommon richness and smooth, luxurious texture.
Hot.
Juggernaut Hillside Cab is a wine that is fierce, brave, and delicious. Mm.
I dig it.
I dig it too.
Also, I didn't know that there was a grape called... How long have we been doing this podcast? I did not know there was a grape called the Juggernaut.
Same.
That is basically like the CrossFit of grapes. It's like, what the fuck? Well, that's amazing. Also...
Well, and I don't know if they're just saying Juggernaut grapes as in like the wine is called Juggernaut. Like the,
oh, the like maker the grapes of they the... use.
Or they're saying like... Because the company is called Juggernaut, they're the grapes owned by the company or Juggernaut. Because
I'm imagining grapes with a six pack.
Same.
And a hearty beard.
Same.
That's like, oh, is it cold in here? I didn't notice. I'm naked. Like, these grapes are the dude that we all knew in college who wore shorts, even when it was like negative 12 outside.
And they're like, they're it's not that cold. They're in shorts and
a Hawaiian button up.
So yeah, this Juggernaut makes two wines. They make this, which is the Hillside Cab Sauv, and then they make a Russian River Pinot Noir.
Ooh, what's on the Pinot Noir? Because I said like alpha giant, predators,
like eagle hawk thing. Oh, it's real cool. It's
like a thunderbird. Great cryptid. What's your favorite cryptid, Kelly? Now that we're talking about spooky stuff and we can really dive into that creepy part of our personalities.
I don't know. It kind of just changes, like with my mood.
I get that. I would say the Deer Woman, which I have covered, but I believe she's real. She is not a cryptid. She is a spirit that lives inside of all of us to smash creepy fuck boys. But the Jackalope, I love.
Yeah, Jackalope's a good fucking one.
Because I feel like the entire Southwest of the United States was like, let's punk the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Because, okay.
Because you can buy, like, little statues or you can buy, like, actual dead rabbits with just antlers attached to them.
Okay, there is this bar downtown, and it's been renamed and rebranded and redecorated, but when it was its previous iteration, the Doggery, they had a jackalope head mounted on the wall in a gold frame, and my friend Tierney and I, what's up, T, friend of the podcast, she and I were there on one of the last nights that they were open, just by happenstance. We didn't even know they were closing. And the waitress tells us this, because they're like, oh, hey, we're running out of ingredients, because obviously we're not restocking, so we only have these drinks available. And I look at Tierney, I'm like, do you think anyone would care if I just, like, took that jackalope off the wall? Like, who do you think gets that? Like, can I ask for it? What is the social moray for asking for a jackalope off of a failing distillery?
Like, we know you're closing. Can I have a jackalope?
Has anyone called dibs yet? What are the rules of dibs in this situation? But she went to, I think it was Wall Drug in South Dakota, which is a pretty famous tourist trap. And she brought me back a jackalope magnet.
Nice.
And I was like, oh my God, you know me.
We probably could have found one in Texas if we really looked.
I was actually shocked. I only saw one piece of Texas merch with a jackalope reference. And it wasn't very impressive, so I did not get it.
So what are we cheersing to? The jackalope?
You know what? Cheers to witchy bitchies and the Deer Woman who lives inside all of us.
Heck
and
yeah.
Jackalopes, which are totally real. We're still drinking out of our fucking patriarchy glasses, so there's not so much of a clink as a hearty thunk.
Yeah.
But
I'll let Emily drink as I start.
Hold on.
It is very good, though. So on their actual... Jesus.
No, it's not because it's bad. It's because I accidentally inhaled it a little bit.
So on their actual website, they say the flavor profile is dense and velvety with vanilla and ripe black currants. I have no idea what a ripe black currant actually tastes like, so but I can taste the hint of vanilla.
I used to get... So when I was in Scotland, I've never tried this in the United States, so I don't know if they do it here. But I used to get, like, cider. So when I was in Scotland, cider is huge there. And then I got back to the U.S., and that's when cider really started picking up. Like, Angry Orchard was starting to appear everywhere, and now they have ciders of all manner and fashion, which I was very fortunate for because I do not like beer. But I would get a cider with a shot of black currant in it.
It was really good.
Delicious. And yeah, it's kind of like a dark berry. And this is a lot thicker than the one that we drank last week. Like, remember how I was talking about how, like, coats your mouth? The last one was very refreshing and just kind of like was a splash. This one coats your mouth. This is a thick, good winter wine. This wine will get you to Target in the winter when, you know, it snowed 20 billion inches and you're in your orange snowsuit and there are bodies that are slowly being buried in the storm and you're just trying to get some caribou.
You're just trying to get some
caribou. I think you read
caribou on your way to Target.
I think you read that, like, on our 50th episode, the whole, great, like, what a Minnesotan winter is, and it's all of us trying to get to Target in our newspaper padded snowsuits, where the bodies will be found in the spring with the thaw. The bodies of those who didn't make it to Target.
I'll have to read it again.
Oh, man. There's this page on Facebook. I think it's called, like, Oat Minnesota, and it's just full of Minnesota memes. And there was a Target meme, which I feel like applies to most people who feel the way about Target that I feel. But it's like going to Target and leaving with everything but the thing you went there for. I'm like, yes. Yeah.
There's literally a website that's opelife.com, and it's just like t-shirts and shit about Minnesota. So, like, the first one is 1991 Halloween blizzard survivor.
That might be the website for this page, because I've seen that merch on there. And I'm like, if I lived here in 1991, because I was alive during that time, but I was living in Illinois.
Yeah, so I did live there, but I was like several months old. So I technically survived it, but I also didn't go out in it to go trick-or-treating.
Yeah, it's a different kind of thing. I remember one year of Halloween in Illinois, like, our Octobers didn't get too ridiculous as far as I remember. The other thing is, I was a little kid running to houses to get candy. Cold was literally not a factor in any of my memories.
That's funny.
But there was one October that was particularly cold, and I dressed up as Hermione, because it was like when the first Harry Potter movie came out. So I had a pink sweater, jeans, and the robe. Because this is before, like, the movies became super popular. You could buy, like, the skirt and the sweater vest and everything. So I dressed up as her from the, like, some of the original illustrations. My friend was Crookshanks, the cat. So it was also in, like, a very warm outfit.
Yeah.
And then our other friend was, like, a little pilgrim girl. But her mom was a lot. Okay. And she made her wear a whole ass winter coat over her costume. So it was just like her in this poofy winter coat with a blue skirt sticking out and sneakers. Everyone's like, what the fuck are you? And she's like, I'm a pilgrim.
I remember buying costumes like two or three sizes too big so that your costume would fit over your winter
coat. I never had to deal with that. But my mom also made my costumes a lot of the time. Like, I went as a black cat several years where I just wore like a black sweatshirt, black sweatpants, gloves. My mom painted my face and I had ears and a tail. It was like a really chill Halloween in the 90s. Anyway, what were we talking about?
I was going to start my story.
Okay, please do. So, again, we are covering women that you probably do not want to emulate. And if you do, you should definitely seek therapy and question everything about yourself.
Strong therapy.
Especially for this episode.
Just not with me.
Because I feel like sometimes we try to kick off Spooky Month with, like, a like, oh my God, it's a London girl gang who didn't murder anyone.
We like ease into it. This year we're like, fuck this shit.
It's been 3 years. Buckle, strap in and strap on because shit's about to get deadly. We're also gearing up for our first whining about. So we're drinking.
Yeah, we're drinking.
Drinking is happening.
Heavily.
So much. But like a healthy heavily. Like not like
enough. We have Taco Bell coming.
The
pinnacle of drinking.
The food you have when you're making super healthy choices. Always. As right. Kelly pours more wine. Let's do this. Kelly, tell us about your...
Bitch.
Your awful, horrible, evil, bitchy lady.
So I'm covering Maria Swanenberg, which I actually really like that last name.
I do too. Swanenberg.
So Maria was the daughter of Clemens and Johanna.
I love the name Johanna.
Right.
Or Johanna.
Johanna.
Ugh.
So I don't know anything about like her first beau, but she had two daughters with someone, I assume.
Someone who had semen that somehow entered her and she produced two female children.
Exactly. Unfortunately, both of her daughters died at a young age.
Oh, shit.
And she would go on to marry Johannes van der Linden.
Okay. So this, I love that her mom is Johanna and she marries a Johannes.
Yeah, this is maybe in the Netherlands.
Okay. I kind of figured.
Dutch.
Deutsch.
It's in Leiden, Linden.
Come at us, Deutschland. No, that's Germany. Crap.
Yeah. So it's in particularly South Holland, Netherlands.
Come at us, Denmark. Right?
No.
No?
Netherlands.
I thought you said Dutch, though. Isn't that?
Yes, that's part of the Netherlands. Denmark speaks Danish.
Where the fuck is Denmark? Is that a country or a
city? It's right above Germany.
Well, son of a bitch.
It's technically part of the Scandinavian countries, but it's not attached to the rest of them. Yep.
I'll show you
a map later.
I plead the fifth on the fact that I've been drinking. Also, American education failed me.
That's probably a better one. Anyways. So her first two daughters died at a young age. She married Johannes van der Linden, which I just really like saying van der Linden.
Oh, it reminds me of Lindt chocolate.
And so we're in about 1868.
Okay. I am firmly placed in time. We are about 30 years before Lizzie Borden murders, allegedly, her parents.
So the result of this marriage, even though the kids will never come up again, though, is she had 5 sons and 2 daughters.
And hopefully those children all lived wonderful, well-adjusted lives, and they were great.
So
they were very happy.
In contrary to the rest of the story, Maria had a nickname around her village, and it was Goeieme, which means good in Dutch, which aww. I'm pretty sure I'm butchering that. So, and it's because she was known to be neighborly. She would assist with babysitting, taking care of the sick, the poor, the elderly, all around Leiden where she lived. Like, so she was known as like a really good person, and that was like her, like she was known as like good Maria or good May.
Really quick, in Kelly's defense, she listened to like 10 different pronunciations.
They all were slightly different.
They were all, some of them were entirely different, but this seemed to be the most consistent thread. So, if this is not correct, please let us know. We want to learn and do better.
Also,
but Kelly didn't make this shit up.
No.
She tried.
If someone is from the area, so this was one I actually had a lot of trouble finding because this is one that like, it was Wikipedia copy and pasted through like every other source except for like one. And then this one other source was like, oh, there's all this information from police reports and stuff, but it must all be like local and not on the internet because I couldn't find shit.
You know what?
That's how we're starting this story.
Okay, really quick. So obviously you both listen to a lot of true crime podcasts and there are some cases from non-US or even non-European countries where it's hard to piece together the story because a lot of the publications about the story have not been published in English, which like fair. English is not the universal world language. I get that. But I guess I think it's interesting that even though the internet is supposed to be this great fount of knowledge, we still have the cultural and language barriers getting in the way of us finding information that is accessible to one group of people, but not to another. Not criticizing, we're just as bad. But I'm like, I thought the internet was supposed to be the great fount of knowledge.
Right.
Just saying. Apparently not. Maybe someone get on those translations.
Someone photocopy everything and then translate it. Anyways.
I'm learning Spanish. I'm working on my bit.
So even though she was known as Good Maria, she was a serial killer. We're just going to jump right into it. Because like I said, there wasn't a lot of information. And so all I have is like the really... So
Cheerios, Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Yeah. She hated it at all.
Her first victim was her mother, Johanna, in 1880. So she was 12. No. 68 to 80. Yeah, 12.
Shut up.
She was 12 years old.
No. Yeah. No.
Right? 1868 to 1880? That's 12 years, right?
Here's the thing. All preteens suck. But they do not suck this bad.
She then went on to murder her father, Clemens, shortly thereafter.
Wait. I feel like we entirely skipped over the murder of the mother. So, like,
yeah, that's it. That's all I have is that she murdered her mother in 1880.
There's not even a how she didn't get caught for
arsenic.
It.
All of her murders were done by arsenic or some form of poisoning.
Some moms just can't handle their arsenic. It has to happen at least once this month.
Oh, trust me, I was going to.
It's
going
to happen again. I promise you.
Some people just can't hold their arsenic.
God, I did an oral interpretation for a speech class of that song. And every time I said, like, pop six, yeah, you.
Pop six, squish. Cicero. Lip shits.
I like made eye contact with a different member of the class.
Oh my God, I love you.
And it was, I regret it a little now. But at the time, it felt, it was a great speech. I kicked ass.
I bet you did.
I'm pretty sure I won best shit. I won best speech a lot in that class.
Should I continue talking about poisoning? Because we're like way off topic at this
point.
I am
so sorry. Let me stop singing my speech praises. Tell me about how this 12-year-old poisoned her fucking parents.
Yeah, I don't really know. That was the extent of the information on her parents.
It's not that it was super hard.
So Marie would go on to murder probably around 65 people by sneaking arsenic into their food or drinks. This was between 1864 and 1883. So like between when she was born in 1883, at least 23 of them would die.
Okay.
So she poisoned at least 65 people and about 23 of them died. So for decades, rumors and even news reports have falsely claimed that she probably poisoned over 100 people, but most like researchers that have done more research, because there is a book out, but it's only in Dutch, and I can't read Dutch. I guess I don't actually know if it came out, because the news article I read said he was writing a book, so I don't know if it ever, this was in 2019. I never actually looked it up because I'm like, it's in Dutch. Like, there was no English translation.
Yeah. And it's not that we don't want to learn. It's just that it's not going to happen in the next year.
I can't read Dutch.
We're struggling with Espanol.
So that was one of like the big rumors. And another like false account was that she was like an alluring femme fatale that was like this like gorgeous woman that would like lure people in and then she would murder them. Whereas actually, like, if this is proven and people have been able to research it, she actually dressed like a pauper and like lived super poorly and would like take care of other people. And like, she like, so she was like weirdly like kind, but also a murderer.
You know what I think is interesting though? Like, just let's talk about this from like a feminist perspective for 2 seconds and not like murder is feminist. It's super not. But the whole idea that, well, she must have been a sexy, alluring femme fatale,
like,
because
women, she just murdered people.
Women are condemned for their sexuality. Either, well, you're a victim because of your sexuality. You were too sexy, or you're evil because you're too sexy. You know, it's always a negative. It can't be like, this super average lady was getting away with this shit because no one questions a woman buying poison and making food for a bunch of people.
It's weird. So Maria obviously managed to hide her crimes for a number of years. Due to various factors, including the high death rate caused by the deplorable living conditions found in the neighborhood she lived in, which was a very destitute neighborhood. Local doctors often actually shunned that area, and house calls to the area were rare, if like if they ever happened at all. So no one suspected this very humble, good, quote unquote, woman of being anything other than a saint of taking care of sick people. She spent her life in poverty and was always eager to help friends, families, neighbors during her times of trouble. That's how she earned her nickname. Obviously, she had this very matronly persona, even from a young age, which made this revelation of her like super brazen murders, like very shocking. And actually, like, one of her most brazen murders was she poisoned several people at a funeral by sneaking arsenic into their coffee.
How dare she?
I know. I'm like, Jesus Christ, woman.
Disrespect the sanctity of coffee. But, you know, so, this is very like Ted Bundy.
Oh, yeah.
Because, okay, Ted Bundy, people called into the tip line. They're like, hey, my coworker, my friend, my acquaintance, Ted, you might want to look into him. He drives that creepy bug. He's sketch. And no one looked in because he was the quintessential nice guy.
Well, and that's why he killed so many people, is because he had that like look. He had that affect where he was like, hey, yeah, I need some help. And people were like, oh, my gosh, let me help you.
He also pretended to have like a broken arm or leg. Oh, yeah. Like
But he still, yes, he looked nice.
Yes.
That's the main thing. Like, he dressed well. He was a clean shaven person. Like, he didn't look like a homeless person. So yeah, he looked like he was broken, but nice.
He took advantage of people's reliance on determining whether or not someone is dangerous from their appearance.
Exactly.
100%. And it seems like she's doing the same thing. And she's also kind of doing a Jane Taupin thing where she's taking care of the sick, but is she also killing them? Is she like kind of doing that angel of death shit?
Right.
Like, oh my God, you're sick. Let me feed you soup. Oh my God, it's full of arsenic. And everyone's going to think I'm a great person.
That's what I feel like she was probably doing.
I wonder what she got out of this, because obviously it wasn't money.
No. Although that was one of like, I'll skip ahead and then come back.
Oh,
I'm
sorry.
That was like one of the things, like people were never really sure of what her motives were. There have been some claims, and even if you read Wikipedia now, like that there are a lot of claims that are like, oh, it was an insurance scam. She took insurance out on people. But if she was taking insurance scams on people, why was she so poor and broke and living on the streets? Like, and she, like, after she got arrested, it came out that she owed money to a ton of fucking people. So it's like, clearly it wasn't an insurance scam. She was probably just a psychopath.
This is the other feminist point. And again, people don't think
women are psychopaths.
Well, not saying that murder is feminist. Again, I can't reiterate that enough. Murder sucks. I don't care.
Murder is fantastic. No, I'm kidding. Kelly, I'm just super drunk.
Can you see it
in my cheeks? Because I can feel it in my cheeks.
I can hear it. I love it. Oh my God.
You can see it.
Kelly, do you want to tongue fuck me right now?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We need to take a break, guys. Hold on.
Okay, but here's the thing. Because women are painted as the caregivers, and statistically, women are victims of violent crime versus the perpetrators. That being said, we do not give enough credit that there are women who just like to hurt people
for the sake of hurting people. Like, for some reason, society... More, I guess now we can kind of wrap our minds around it, but especially back then in the 1800s or 1900, whatever, 1880, whatever, people could not wrap their minds around the fact that women could kill just because they wanted to kill. That made no sense to people.
Even Eileen Wuornos. Now, granted, she had a pretty horrific upbringing, but we don't let Ted Bundy, Edmund Kemper, all these other people who had horrible upbringings slide because, you know, they had these bad upbringings and then kill. But Eileen Wuornos, oh, she's this tragic figure. She's, oh my gosh. No!
She is like a weird tragic.
Fuck her.
People made like her a she was like raped by all these men and, you know, that's why she murdered them.
Like, she was a woman taking back the power.
She might have been.
No, she was not.
Maybe the first murder. Maybe the second murder. But toward the end, she was murdering because she wanted to murder.
I firmly believe she was taking out her pre-existing rage on other people.
Oh, 1,000%.
You can be a victim and a perpetrator of violence at the same time. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. But yeah, this whole idea that women can't be monsters is incredibly sexist, and it also blinds us to the fact that, you know, oh my God, who's doing this? Well, it can't be 50% of the population.
No, of course not.
Like,
boobs mean we don't murder for fun.
Well, statistically, okay, this is going to get a little dark for a second. I'm not going to go into details. Women who are...
As I pour, like, a very full glass of red wine.
You're going to need some juggernaut here. Women who are convicted for responsibility of the death of a child often receive heavier sentences than men who are convicted for similar or parallel crimes because women are expected to be the caregivers. It's a great disrespect to their nature.
Right.
It's a rejection of their nature as a woman to hurt a child. Well, men, it's like, yeah, but men suck with kids. They're violent. We expect
this. But if women kill adults, they're like, oh, like, clearly she did it for like monetary value or X, Y, and Z. It's not because she just wanted to murder someone.
But then in the case
whereas
of,
for men, it's like, no, he was a fucking psychopath. All he wanted to do was just murder them.
But then in the cases of like women who kill their abusers, it's like, well, she's just a psycho. It's like, oh,
it's like, I know.
A lot going on.
There is so many contradictions in our society.
There are a lot of layers. Right. Keep telling me about Arsenic Annie here. Good Maria. Not so good Maria.
So needless to say, once she was caught, she was nearly like lynched. Like people were pissed because they were like, we've been trusting you. You've been this like good saintly person. Like the fuck. So, and so she had to get moved from like the local jailhouse in Leiden to Den Haag, which is a different city, to await trial. Like they were like, okay, like if we leave you here, people are just gonna like overwhelm the jail and murder you.
Cool.
What's interesting is journalists from all around Europe like awaited her trial and like all of these things, but there's no fucking information.
Because women killers are, and I hate to say this because it seems dismissive of the pain that they cause. They're novelties.
They are.
We don't expect women to do that.
Kind of gross.
No, it really, honestly, I firmly believe there are way more women killers than we're aware of. Just 1,000.
And there's a lot of women killers I won't touch, though, because they're like baby killers. Like, nope, that's too dark for our podcast.
We're not a true crime podcast. We're not going to go there. I looked at several women that I thought about covering for today, and I decided not to because we're not going to do that. You know what? We're not going to do it. And if we do something like that, it's going to be Patreon. It's going to be focused more on the societal situation that resulted in these women having no, it's a thing. We're not doing that today.
I agree.
We want to keep drinking our wine.
Exactly.
And not throw it up right now.
So the media made her famous around the world, which again, I'm kind of mad because I'm like, I couldn't find any information.
Was there any information about how she was caught?
Nope. Oh, yes. It's coming up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Apparently she was a sensation for only a little while. And yeah, how she got caught was she like basically tried to poison an entire family and like one or two of them were like more resistant than the rest and were basically like, yo, this woman is like trying something. And yeah, it was arsenic poisoning. So that's what they're like 90% sure she poisoned like all of her people with.
Yes. May I? Emily. I swear to God it's relevant. And I know you know this, but for our listeners.
I'm super drunk. It's fine.
That is classic. I forgot the word. Acceleration. Okay. So serial killers.
Explain what you're talking. Oh, it's not acceleration. It's escalation.
Escalation. Thank you very much. But it's classic escalation because a lot of serial killers, they start out kind of slow and small.
Yeah. One person.
And they get.
Family members, loved ones, people close to them.
Yep. And they ramp up because one, they're getting a lot more confident in their pattern. You know, they've refined their system for committing these atrocities. Also, they're getting cocky because they're getting away with this time and time again. And a lot of times that's when they get caught, when they just get a little too brazen. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me with this shit right now?
So the preliminary investigation covered more than 90 suspected deaths. It took a year and a half to complete. Actually, more than a year and a half. In addition, the judge also instructed on ordered examination of Maria's like mind, like to see if she was sane.
Oh, like a psychological evaluation. Yeah. You would, but love that's not that. What they
100%. That's honest. Okay. Brief tangent. That is what I used to want to do. There used to be a TV show on one of the crime networks that I can't think of off the top of my head because I'm super drunk. Nope. No. Well, I mean, yes, but no. No. Like, his last name is Stone, but he had, like, this ranking, like, of a scale of 1 to 10 of, like, the most evil. That's what it was called. It was on whatever channel
Discovery,
that was.
Discovery! Most evil?
Yeah. It doesn't exist anymore, and I can't find it anywhere, and it makes me angry.
That used to be listed as one of my favorite shows on Facebook.
But, so, like, I used to watch that, and that's, like, he was, like, a criminologist, and that's what I used to, like, a psychological criminologist, and that's what I used to want to do. Anyway, so... So they tested like her mental faculties and they actually tested her with two different people just to like make sure everything was on the up and up. Quote, her mind showed a high degree of harshness and all that physical and psychological examination to declare that the accused was in full possession of her mental faculties. She was sane. She knew 100% what she was doing.
She was sane, but she was just literally the worst.
Yeah.
Which so 90% of them
are. The hearing took course before the Hague Court of Appeal on the 23rd and 24th of April, 1885. They demanded a life sentence and also pointed out that she was a great danger. And basically, like, she brought her up as a psychological, her defendant. They were like, she's a psychological anomaly and an error of nature. And
yeah, like
I did like that.
She's a freak of nature.
I kept that in. An error of nature.
An error of nature.
Technically, it was erreur de la nature, or however you say that in Dutch. I'm sorry, that sounded very condescending. However you say that in Dutch.
Well, I love that you said it. And if you told me that was French, I would have been like, wow, you did
it sounded
a really great
like French,
job.
Yeah.
But so, again, this whole idea that a woman who kills is an anomaly, what I really don't think they are.
So she was sentenced to, she was found guilty of poisoning three times and sentenced to life imprisonment. The Dutch Supreme Court rejected the appeal that she did several times, and she spent the rest of her life in prison.
Good riddance.
I'm
to
not
good
done yet.
To bad rubbish.
So
no,
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 no. I'm done with her. I'm not done with other people.
Okay.
So people like to make money off of serial killers. We know that.
Yes.
So obviously, like I said before, the media made her famous, if not only for a short time, and she became so notorious, particularly in the Netherlands, that she was part of the Nederlandse Potticadam Wax Museum, which is in Amsterdam.
Oh my
God. I don't
God.
Know if she's still there. I couldn't find that information, but she was part of their Chamber of Horrors, which was a gallery of various like killers, torture devices, stuff like that. And it actually helped make the museum the second most visited attraction in the entire city of Amsterdam in 1884. People, including like the United States ambassador, visited.
Okay, this is a woman that you could barely find information on that we have never heard of, but she was such a viral sensation of her time. And now we've forgotten her. I don't know. Just like
people made songs about her. There was apparently a drawing, like a bunch of drawings of her, whether in the courtroom or other places. There was a photo, which obviously in like 1884 photos were pretty rare. But there was a photo of her like taken in prison, which like copies of that sold like fucking hotcakes.
Like 90s Beanie Babies.
Even though like there were people in the country, in the Netherlands, because they had abolished the death penalty by then. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge debate when she came up to trial of whether or not to reinstate the death penalty. That's how heinous they viewed her crimes. It's like, do we reinstate the death penalty because this woman was such an atrocious person that we should probably murder her? But you can't find any information about her nowadays.
You know what it makes me? It makes me think of some of the most prolific cases of our modern age, like Chris Watts. And it's like, in 100 years, is it just going to be one of those things? Like, yeah, we've never heard of him, but apparently, like, him murdering his entire family was a big deal for the time. Or, like, only people who are into true crime are going to remember that. And though his poor wife and his poor daughters, who he callously took their lives.
River Falls, right?
No.
Oh.
No, this was in Colorado. This is the
guy in River Falls did that, too.
Oh, that didn't even make, like, national headlines. That was just a River Falls thing.
Somehow, barely two-page story has made us 40 minutes into an episode.
Here's the thing. There's a lot to talk about in regards, beyond our tangents, to the way that women are viewed in relation to committing crimes.
Right.
And here's the thing. There are plenty of women who have been fucking nailed to the cross for crimes that they should not have been held responsible for. Like Cyntoia Brown is a great example, especially like women and girls of color being held more responsible for crimes than like,
I mean, but you see that in men too.
Male adults. But this is one of those cases where it's like, well, why not a woman?
Right.
And I'm not saying we should all aspire to be murderers. I'm just saying it can happen.
It's
And like, sexism hurts all of us.
Exactly. Okay. So after she was sent to prison, many in Leiden obviously like were like, let's just forget she existed, especially the people related to her. Because obviously she had so many fucking children. And what's interesting is that the writer that was writing that book in Dutch, like reached out to her surviving family members and like none of them wanted to talk to him.
I wouldn't want to either.
Eventually, apparently like two of them talked to him, but obviously I'm guessing if the book ever got published, that's in the book because they didn't talk about it in the articles I found. However, her husband eventually did manage to remarry. He got like really ill. Not surprisingly.
Kind of surprised like, she didn't murder him.
Like, that's the thing. After what a lot of the article said was, like, following a serious illness, I'm like, no, she was probably fucking poisoning him.
Oh, my God.
But obviously, like, it's still known as one of, like, the most sensational murders of that of Leiden. So if you or anyone you know live in Leiden, please get me more information and I'll do, like a side episode on her, just
like,
her.
Do you have a hometown? Do you have like a first time you heard about it? Are there like weird rumors? Like, is there any more insider information you have?
Right. I will say, due to this trial, some things were brought up that ended up benefiting the community, because obviously it was brought up that like there was a carefree attitude of doctors toward the patients in those working class / lower class neighborhoods. So obviously it was like, that's why she got away with it for so long.
She was preying on people who were already vulnerable.
Exactly. Heavy poisons were easily available to buy. There was funeral insurance, which I don't understand what that was. And that was one of the things that some people said that that's what she was using to gain money. But she wasn't. It's a thing. But basically, like, there was a lot of things that got brought up from her trial that ended up changing things maybe for the better.
I don't think we can view tragedies like this as a, like, oh, well, good came, you know, like, good versus bad. I think it's like, hey.
Things happened afterward.
A really bad thing happened, and good stuff came from it. Those two things can be, can exist in the same sphere. They're not mutually exclusive. We can learn our lessons. Yeah.
Sorry.
Kelly's like using her super fun psych lingo.
But, like, also, like, psychological and psychiatric aspects weren't super used. And so the fact that they were in this both pre-trial and trial was a huge thing. So that makes me really excited, obviously. So there are some people that say that Maria was one of the deadliest killers in history, or most prolific female serial killers in history. But there's a lot of trouble determining that, as me and Emily have discussed throughout this episode about female serial killers and just how people view them. So here's one of the reasons that this title is very dubious, and it really depends on what metrics you use. Do you go by what people say they may have done, or do you go by what can actually be proven? So there was an American serial killer, Jane Toban. Emily has talked about her. She confessed to 31 murders when she was arrested, but they can only confirm around 12. There are also other people, such as Amelia Dreyer, which is a Victorian era Briton person who we're not even going to talk about or like go into details, but supposedly she killed up to 400 victims, which earned her the name the Ogress of Reading. Juana Barraza, who I covered.
Yes.
Who is currently serving. I actually think she may have died. I need to check that.
Here, you keep reading your notes. Yeah, I will check Google it that. For you.
But she's currently serving, or was serving, 759 years in prison for killing at least 11 women. And no one seems to agree on the actual account of many of these women. Some sources claim it was as high as 48 for Juana.
She's still alive and she's 64 years old.
There you go.
Which
so
is
she is still
shockingly
in
not that old.
However, they know from extensive research, like police actually did a lot of extensive research. And again, this is all because like one writer dug into the police files, which are apparently not on the internet. They're almost 100% confident that Maria killed 23 people based on the evidence the police found in her trial. And because they can actually trace all 23 murders back to her, they argue that she is the deadliest female serial killer of all time. Just because everyone else is like, oh, they say, or like, just because she has the most proven kills of any other serial killer.
And we know little to nothing about her.
Yeah. So if anyone like lives in the area and can find me more information, like honestly, even if I don't make another like episode on her, I would just love to read some of like the court transcripts and stuff.
Again, this is a constant learning experience for us.
So that is Maria Swanenberger. No, Berg.
Swanenberg.
Swanenberg. My wine voice is like burger.
Yeah, no, I feel that.
Hey guys, we know times have been tough lately for all of us.
And during hard times, it can be difficult if you don't have anyone to talk to, or it can be hard to talk about certain topics.
Being alone with your thoughts can be isolating. This is why we are sponsored by BetterHelp.
BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen to and help you.
Talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Thank goodness.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that gives you access to the help that may not be available in your area.
You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. That is Amazon fast. Then you schedule secure video and phone sessions. Plus, you can exchange unlimited messages, and everything you share is completely confidential, just like with an in-person therapist.
You can request a new therapist at any time at no additional charges. If you want to talk to someone about your mental health, you can get a 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/herstory. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/herstory. So that was my story about Maria. Emily, who are you horribly whining about?
Okay, so I feel like your ovaries are glowing because we're in sync, because I'm also covering a Black Widow bitch. And I'm just gonna, when I wrote this story, I was kind of writing it in the sense to build suspense.
Ooh, I'm excited.
But it's very obvious when you understand the context of what we're talking about today. So I'm just gonna tell you.
Just do it.
So I am covering Tilly Klimek, the killer clairvoyant.
I like Tilly. I do. That's a good name.
Oh my God. Okay. So she was born Ophelia Otilly Tilly Gaburek. She was born on October 22nd, 1876, which is actually kind of Ophelia. Oh, and it's spelled O-F-F-E-L-I-A.
Oh.
She's Polish. I definitely texted my mom today asking when her grandparents emigrated from Poland.
Yeah.
I was like, what's the timeline here? Were my great-grandparents around? Bound?
Yeah. How interesting would that be?
They were definitely around. And they were definitely in the United States, but they were 100% not on the same ship. Okay. Anyway, so she was born on October 22nd, either 1876 or 1877 in Poland. Quick disclaimer for this story. Names, dates, numbers, even victim names changed depending on the source. So I really, so I heavily relied on findagrave.com when I could, because I'm like, okay, I know tombstones aren't always 100% accurate, but I feel like I can kind of hang my hat on the tombstone records versus these other rando internet articles that have all copied and pasted from each other. So there's a lot of murkiness around this. So I just kind of tried to tell it in the form that was the most conducive narrative and that had the most verifiable details. So if you're familiar with the story and you're like, that's not right, well, none of it's fucking right. Okay. We know nothing. So she was born in 1876 or 1877 in Poland, but she didn't stay there long. Poland had been going through a bit of a time over the last 100 or so years. The country had been occupied and carved up repeatedly, and around the time of Tilly's birth, Russia was the key oppressor.
Yay, Russia.
Which actually, so some of this, like, really, I found really interesting, because one of the reasons that my mom has had a hard time tracing family back to Poland past her grandparents is because Poland was technically Russia at the time that they emigrated from Poland.
Or it was, and it's carved up in various ways.
It's a bureaucratic nightmare. And Ellis Island wasn't exactly the pillar of bureaucratic accuracy.
Yeah, there you
just
go.
Saying. Anyway. So Russia was the key oppressor, and this led to many Polish people, to immigrate to the United States, spurred on by the hope of giving their children a better life without Russian oppression. And Tilly's parents, Mikalina and Mikhail Gaburek, were among them, taking their
understandably
4-year-old daughter or a potentially ish infant. I read it in differently in many places. They took her with them in 1881, which leads me to believe she was like about 4, but I read in so many places she was an infant, and there were a lot of places where they're like, I don't know, she's born in the 1870s.
Toddler,
who the fuck
or
knows?
Younger.
She was a tot. She was a little tater tot. So the Gubureks traveled to Chicago, Illinois, which again, very me. Like, I didn't choose this story. It definitely chose me.
Yeah, it did.
So they traveled to Chicago, Illinois, settling in what is known as Little Poland, which is primarily in near North Side, which is like scary close to the Field Museum. And I totally flew over that when I was returning from Philly. Anyway, here the family grew until Tilly was the oldest of seven children.
Wow.
We've been covering a lot of families with like a crap big ton children. Of children.
Big amounts of mm-hmm. children.
So there wasn't a ton of information on Tilly's childhood, kind of like your story. But what we do know is that she would eventually gain a reputation for being a psychic. Ooh. And this isn't surprising as the spiritualism movement was in full swing at this time. So as the United States coped with the aftermath of a bloody civil war and like a ton of other societal factors, mediums who claimed to be able to speak with the dead became prominent figures traveling across the country to conduct seances, give lectures, and commune with the dead in front of paying audiences. So this whole idea of being psychic, communicating with the dead, this like spooky witch stuff was really prominent. And it was, I think more importantly, really profitable.
Yeah, that's the big one. I mean, even today.
Yes. So Long Island medium, whatever. Her hair is so big because it has so many secrets.
So many secrets.
So some of the most prominent spiritualists were women, and they were able to use this platform to advance socially and economically. However, some of the most famous mediums from the time were proven to be or admitted to being frauds. And if you know anything about Houdini, he was this was his hobby.
Mm-hmm.
This was his like side hustle with magic. He's like, well, I literally use illusions and sleight of hand in my craft. I know you're full of shit. So he would go around to these mediums proving them wrong.
Right.
And then even his wife, he was like, okay, if there is an afterlife, I'm going to come back. Either it was on the anniversary of his death or on Halloween.
I think it was the anniversary
and like,
of
I'm
going to
let you know. And his wife held a seance
every year.
Every year until she died. And there was never anything. Which I'm like, I don't know. If I died and then like realized I could totally commune with the living. And I had spent my entire life saying it was bullshit. Would I be so salty where I would just not?
Right.
Maybe.
Maybe.
So it's likely that Tilly's claims of second sight would have given her clout in her community. But it's hard to determine when exactly she began exhibiting these abilities, as we don't know much about her early life. In a classic history trope, she doesn't feature prominently in the historic record until 18 years old when she married a 23-year-old man. Yes, Kelly knows what the fuck is up. Named Joseph Mitkowitz in 1895. Okay. So Joseph had also been in Poland. Been born in Poland on November 1st, 1873, before immigrating to the United States in 1882, just a year after Tilly's family, actually. So, well, again, she's growing up in Little Poland. There's a huge Polish community.
Right, so they
many
probably
of them
knew
are
each other.
Immigrants,
yeah.
Descendants of immigrants. So it's possible that the pair knew each other in their younger days before being married. And just a couple years later, they had their first child, Joseph Jr. Quick disclaimer, like I said at the beginning, a lot of the victims' names were switched around. So Joseph was also called Joe and John and all these other things. Joseph is what's on his gravestone, according to findagrave.com. That's what I went with. So the couple rented a house on Sloan Street in Chicago, and Joseph supported the young family as a truck inspector for Illinois Central Railroad.
Ooh.
And by all accounts, the marriage was a happy one. Both Joseph and Tilly were respected in their community, and Tilly was known as an excellent cook, particularly when it came to a specialty stew that she was known to make.
Oh my God, did we both cover arsenic killers?
Put that away in your vault. Anyway, it was after her marriage that Tilly's reputation as a psychic really began to grow, or either began to grow or began to manifest, because again, we don't know. She experienced prophetic dreams in which she would see someone and be able to predict their exact date of death.
That's creepy.
Sometimes she dreamed of stray dogs that bothered her or an obnoxious neighbor. But regardless of what her dreams foretold, she always seemed to be right. And this is why no one was surprised that on January 13th, 1914, after Tilly had began telling neighbors that she was having death dreams about her husband becoming sick, that Joe succumbed to a sudden illness and died. His death was attributed, you know, we're not going to think about it. Words are words. To heart trouble, and Joseph was buried in All Saints Polish National Catholic Cemetery in Chicago, Illinois. And I was brought up Catholic because my mother, her parents, and her grandparents were Catholic. So a lot of the victims are in this Polish community and are Catholic. So it was like another like, oh my God, that's why I'm Catholic, because my ancestors came from Poland. I mean, that tradition dies with me, but whatever. It's like a fun
little... For many reasons.
For so many reasons. So Tilly, the grieving widow, had a $1,000 life insurance policy to comfort her, which is just under $30,000 today. Nothing to sneeze at.
That's not bad.
Probably not worth a human life, but just saying. Along with the company of a new suitor.
Oh.
John Ruskowski. And I've read his name as Joseph also, but according to findagrave.com, he's listed as John, so that's what I'm going with. There are a lot of Josephs that come up, whether it's first or middle names, but Joseph keeps popping up. So this also helps me to differentiate.
Yeah.
So John was a laborer who had been born in Germany in 1864, where he had served in the German army before immigrating to the U.S. alone. He did have family back in Germany, but as far as the United States went, he was alone. So John was the embodiment of the American dream. He was a hard worker, laboring in a coal mine and saving his money, and desperate for advancement, which, again, that's the whole, you know, myth of America. It's like you work hard, you work your way up, and you make something of yourself. So he learned shoe repair and started his own business, opening the only shoe store in Minnick, Illinois, which is southwest of Chicago. So he had talked of buying the lot next to his business with plans to expand. So he's gone to a totally new country. He's worked the shit job. He's learned a new skill. He's worked his way up. He's getting ready to expand his business. He's really got everything going for him.
Yeah.
And in several sources, it was reported that John lived nearby. But when I looked it up, Minnick, Illinois is like a 2.5 hour drive from Chicago. And I wouldn't describe that as nearby now, let alone in the 1900s. But whatever. Again, there are a lot of details of the story that are
confusing.
Confusing, but essentially to the point of the story, kind of irrelevant. So I'm not sure of the circumstances, but John and Tilly met and were married on February 27th, 1914. The same year, another man close to Tilly, allegedly an ex-boyfriend named Joseph Gruntowski, who had apparently jilted her, he also died. He got sick and died. So really quick, I've been throwing a lot of dates at you, and I want to recap the timeline because it was one of those things I realized halfway through my research. Also, we've been drinking.
I appreciate that.
So at the beginning of 1914, Tilly begins having premonitions of her husband, Joseph, dying. By January 13th, so within 13 days, he dies. Then just over a month later, on February 27th, she remarries.
Wow.
And in that same span, an ex-boyfriend also dies at some point. So in like a month and a half, two people are dead and she's remarried. Just saying. So John was the picture of health, strong and robust. So Tilly's neighbors were hopeful that this marriage would last. Like, John's got staying power. He's successful. He's got money. He's healthy. You know what? Everyone has at least like one mulligan of a husband to die in the early 1900s.
That's true.
That's just the times we live in. But this one really seems like he's going to last. But in May of 1916, this is just like a little over 2 years later, Tilly began telling neighbors that she had a dream that John would die on May 20th.
It's very specific.
Very specific. Too specific, perhaps. Anyone who had previously died Tilly's clairvoyance were brought to their knees when the once healthy John became sick and died on May 20th, 1916, at either like 51 or 52 years old.
Wow.
He was buried in Minnunk Township Cemetery. And this was like a huge shock to the people back in Minnunk because they were like, whoa, he was fine.
Like that he was robust. He was healthy. Was in like the prime of his life.
Yeah. The actual fuck. So the now twice widowed Tilly was left with $722 from John's life insurance and $1,200 in cash, which in total was about $54,000 today. We see these numbers going up.
Yeah, shocking.
Also, I didn't include this because these notes are already very long, but she was kind of the initiator of these life insurance policies. So her husband, the men in her life, willingly took out these life insurance policies, but at her behest.
She was like, honey, I think this is a good idea.
Which, I mean, normally, yes. Unless your wife is Tilly.
Right.
So once again, Tilly found comfort with another man shortly after John's death. John Guskowski was Joseph. J-O-S-E-F. I'm going to call him Joseph because, again, a lot of Josephs. So Joseph Guskowski was likely another Polish immigrant who had come to the United States with his family. And unfortunately, we don't know much about Joseph. I put as much in here about the victims as I could.
Which I appreciate.
Unfortunately, we probably wouldn't know anything about them if they hadn't been associated with these horrible events. So I really tried to present their humanity as much as I could. Unfortunately, there's not a ton of information. According to family lore, after courting or marrying, I couldn't tell definitively.
Something.
Because every...
Shacking up with
like,
Tilly.
After husband number two, the numbers get really murky. So after hooking up, becoming involved with Tilly in some way, shape, or form, the couple and Joseph's sister, Stella, snacked on candy. Or perhaps it was just Joseph and Stella who ate the candy because both became violently ill after eating it, and Joseph died. Sus. Soup sus. Franciscus Frank Kupczyk was born on August 17th, 1880 in Poland.
Immediately.
There's no good segue for the... And there was so little information about him, unfortunately. So he was born in 1880 in Poland and immigrated to the U.S. where he settled in Chicago. This, my grandfather, who was the son of Polish immigrants, and I checked with my mom, her maternal grandparents, I think, immigrated to the United States in... like 1913, 1914. Mm-hmm. So in a similar era, like they were in the United States, but they settled on the East Coast. Like they went through Ellis Island, settled on the East Coast, and they stayed there. So my maternal grandmother came here in 1913, yep. My mom's maternal grandmother, and her paternal grandfather about 1904.
Okay.
So this is a similar date range. And my grandfather, who was... He was born in the United States, but he was the son of Polish immigrants. His name was Frank. And this, I was like, I don't like this. Which I don't like any of this, but it was kind of a weird, like, I'm already feeling these weird personal connections. So Frank and Tilly, or Franciscus and Tilly, were married in 1919, and he moved into Tilly's apartment at 924 North Winchester Avenue, which is now known as Old Lady Tilly Klimek's Haunted House.
Valid.
In guidebooks, because she's the worst.
Yeah.
So she had previously shared this home with a boyfriend who went by the name of Myers.
Who probably also died.
He just, like, disappeared. He ghosted her in a literal or figurative sense. Based on her track record, I'm just going to let you all make the judgment. So their marriage, even by public appearances, was not happy until he began cheating on Frank. Like, she took a lover, it seemed to be like kind of public knowledge. Like, she was just stupping Frank. And in 1921, Tilly began having more of her deadly dreams and reported them to her neighbors and even her husband, telling him, quote, "You'll be dying soon. It won't be long now."
Wow.
What a bitch. I don't care.
What a charmer, but
I don't care even if she thinks she's psychic or even if she really was. Fuck you.
Yeah.
So by this time, dying husbands was old news to Tilly, who began preparing for Frank's inevitable demise even as he was alive and growing sicker and weaker by the day.
Wow.
She would sit by Frank's bedside as he languished away, sewing black lace onto the hat that she planned to wear at his funeral.
Jesus Christ.
And she even planned to buy a coffin. According to her landlady, Martha Weselick, Tilly approached her wanting to store a coffin in the communal basement. Martha reported, quote, "I remember Mrs. Kupchik came out in the yard with a piece of newspaper all about a fine coffin for $30, which is like nearly $500 today, which is still like cheap as shit.
Right.
Come on.
A cheap coffin, Jesus.
Anyway, the quote goes on that she was going to get Frank. So she's going to get, she's showing off this coffin that she's going to buy her still living husband.
Yeah, that's not creepy as fuck.
I told her, I chase you in that coffin out. So Martha's like, that's fucked. You do not buy a coffin for a still living person,
good
let alone
you,
your husband. Like, don't you come to me with that shit thinking I'm going to be like, cool, fuck you. Martha's cool. So to this, Tilly responded, my man, he's only got 2 inches to live.
2 inches?
Yep.
That's a weird measurement.
I know. I didn't know you can measure life in, you know, inches with a ruler.
Same.
But you know what? Tilly's also the worst. So then on April 25th, 1921, the 40-year-old Frank died in bed of, according to his death certificate, bronchial pneumonia. Allegedly. Tilly, and I saw this report like in every source I found, but it almost sounds so insane. I put allegedly. Tilly grabbed her now dead husband by the ears and shouted, you devil, now you won't get up again. And this is the point in the story when she should have been arrested immediately.
Yeah, like that actually happened, the point where every newspaper is reporting on it, like.
Well, and I'm just going to say, I know everyone grieves differently. No one grieves like that.
Right.
Just saying. So Frank's death netted Tilly $675 in life insurance, which is approximately $9,700 today. Again, we see these amounts going up with every death. Tilly celebrated by playing what landlady Martha described as, quote, oh, so jolly music on the Victrola.
Creepy.
Which she could definitely afford because she's made so much money
right
off of her dying husbands.
I think that landlady should just kick her out anyways.
She doesn't end up staying there, so that may have either Tilly was like, Martha's on to me, or Martha was like, get your creepy ass out of here, but Tilly does not stay there.
Good.
Frank was buried in St. Adalbert Catholic Cemetery in Niles, Illinois, in the same $30 coffin from the newspaper ad. And Tilly wore the lace-trimmed hat that she had sewn by his bedside to the funeral.
That's so creepy.
She had, like, been making this hat next to his bedside while he was dying, telling him, like, any day now you're going to die and I'm going to wear this hat to your funeral.
Like, how creepy. Like, take him to a fucking hospital.
That's a different level of fucked.
Yeah.
That's, And I'm not trying to be graphic, but I just really want to drive home the callousness and the joy in which Tilly seemed to be getting
this, like,
out of this.
Pleasure.
And also the escalation, because the first two deaths, it was kind of like, whoa, what? Everything seemed to be fine. But it's with Frank
that she's just like
that her escalation becomes very evident. So by this time, suitors were hard to come by. Tilly's reputation as a good cook and a psychic was preceded by her perpetual widowhood.
Yeah.
And also probably her weird attitudes about being a widow and having dying husbands. So despite a mounting pile of dead husbands, another man rose to the challenge.
Jesus Christ.
50-year-old widower Joseph Klimek was a wealthy man in search of a new wife. And this is where she gets her last name. This is why she's known as Tilly Klimek. Mm-hmm. He apparently attended Frank's funeral, either because he knew Frank, because they're probably growing up in the same community, or wanted to catch Tilly's attention. He was on the hunt for a new wife, it sounded like. And this was a time when a man was expected to have a wife.
Yeah.
And it wasn't uncommon for women to be trying to attract a husband and men to be, like, shopping for a wife. So I don't want to be too hard on him. His standards probably could have been higher, just saying. However, the funeral didn't prove to be the love connection he may have hoped for, as Tilly didn't linger long after the ceremony. Like, and I took that to mean... not that she just didn't want to be around people, but the ceremony ended and she's like, okay, I'm outie. I made my appearance. I played the widow and I'm gone.
That's how I took it, yeah.
As Klimek would later recall, quote, she felt too bad to see people. Sure.
We can pretend that, sure.
We can. Honestly, here's the thing. I don't want to like drag him too much because that's what any other normal person would think. Like if your spouse dies... and you don't right. stick and, around the funeral, I'd be like, wow.
He's a widower. Exactly. So he's probably like, you know, when my wife died, I was heartbroken. So I'm sure she feels the same.
Yes. Yes. And especially for women to lose a husband, that creates a lot of
right.
social and economic instability.
Through a very different eyes.
Yeah. We're looking through it in it's October
we're more aware.
Of 2022. And we're talking about awful, horrible women.
Exactly.
But inevitably, the pair got together and were married on July 30th, 1921, much to the chagrin of Klimek's family. And I'm going to refer to him by his last name because his first name's Joseph, which repeats.
Yeah, yep.
Also, he, spoiler, if you couldn't tell by the quotes, he lives.
Oh.
So he defended Tilly, saying that she was a good woman and that he was a healthy man and would stay that way. It's like, obviously, the other husband's just like... weren't healthy.
Weak constitution.
Totally. And valid for the time because it didn't take a lot to kill you at this time. So at this point in her murder spree, because I feel like I can just say it now, Tilly was getting cocky and impatient. She complained that Klimek had a taste for moonshine and other women. Like Tilly was a very jealous woman, even though she's like killing off her husband. She's like, yeah, but I should be the only woman like until I murder him. Because I'm hot Duh. Shit. Like, fuck yeah. you. So she'd do what we all do when we're having relationship problems and began bitching to her cousin or friend or podcast Whoever. Co-host. Yeah. Another, like, especially for women, another gal in her life.
Yeah.
So she began bitching to her cousin, Nellie Kulik. And when Nellie sensibly suggested, quote, why don't you get a divorce from Joseph? You are not getting along very well. Tilly scoffed and said, I will get rid of him some other way.
Jesus.
Which.
Don't tell other people of your crimes.
Well, and this is what we were talking about before, the escalation, the getting cocky, you've been getting away from it for, or getting away with it for so long. You just kind of feel like you can say whatever the fuck you want. Also, just like file Nellie away.
Okay.
Because she's going to come back. So soon, Klimek began falling ill and growing weaker each day. And within only 6 weeks of his symptoms materializing, he was paralyzed from the waist down.
Wow.
He later said, quote, I had shooting pains in my arms and legs. My hands and feet gradually grew numb and the lower part of my body was paralyzed.
That'd be horrifying.
Like you're healthy, you're fine, and all of a sudden your body just starts betraying you like that. Fortunately for, sorry. I'm full of like hiccups and rage. So fortunately for Klimek, he was able to call his doctor, Dr. Peter Burns. And upon examination, Dr. Burns called an ambulance. Because that's the doctor you want on your fucking team.
Fuck yeah.
To take Klimek to the hospital where doctors determined through logic and then like verifiable testing that he was suffering from the effects of long-term arsenic poisoning. Some husbands
our
just
women,
can't hold their arsenic.
Or women are
poisoning is a not an uncommon practice for women.
It's probably the number one.
So Klimek recalled some strange goings on leading up to his illness, like how their dog died after eating a scrap of food Tilly fed it, and how her stew, which she was just so famous for, kind of tasted off. I wonder how she was delivering this arsenic. Finally, on October 27, 1922, officers arrested Tilly Klimek. As Lieutenant Willard Malone placed her under arrest, Tilly told him, quote, "The next one I want to cook dinner for is you. You made all my troubles." I wonder how she was delivering all this arsenic. Just saying. I feel like she's telling us very plainly.
Right?
After an 18-hour interrogation, Tilly finally admitted to poisoning Joseph Klimek with arsenic. But there was a twist. She claimed that her cousin, Nellie Kulik, who she had been bitching to and had suggested she just divorce her husband, provided the arsenic in the form of a poison called Rough on Rats. And she, too, was arrested. I didn't put this in my notes. It's going to be one of those, if I remembered. There's an ad for Rough on Rats, and it's a dead rat, and the slogan is, "Don't die in your house." And I'm like, hopefully not.
Right?
Like, wait, like, me or the rat?
Yeah.
Like, how?
I have questions.
It doesn't rhyme. There's no alliteration. It almost feels like a threat. I have questions. Bad marketing. Bad on you, Rough on Rats. Their tagline is more aggressive than their brand name. Just saying. So, with Joseph Klimek's miraculous escape, Tilly's previous husband's death were now called into question. The bodies of Joseph Mitkowitz, John Ruskowski, and Joseph Guskowski, and Frank Kupchik were all exhumed and found to be chock full of arsenic.
Yeah, some guys just can't hold their arsenic.
I'm glad you said it, because I'm like, I already said it, and this is my story. It feels excessive. Thank you.
I got you.
Thank you for being that person for me. So Chicago, and this is in Chicago.
Yeah.
Cook County comes up.
God damn
this story.
It's probably I wonder if that's who they based that character off of.
I've heard a podcast about who they based it off of. It's not her, but that whole idea of like Chicago having a love affair with femme fatales kind of comes up. Chicago residents began to think back on Tilly's many death predictions, that of the stray dog that bothered her, the obnoxious neighbors, cousins and other relatives, and how they had all fallen mysteriously ill and or died as well after eating food prepared by Tilly. The truth was that Tilly wasn't predicting the future, but scheduling her murders meticulously. Yeah. Her planner must just be a piece of fucking work. I think I'm organized by like recording when I go to the gym, and she's like scheduling murders weeks and months into the future.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Tilly, and your organization. That could have been used for good. You used it for evil. She killed to profit off her husband's life insurance policies or to eliminate people she felt were in her way.
Yeah.
Or she just didn't like them. Get the fuck out. Nah, you bug me. I don't like you. So the list of Tilly's alleged victims grew to nearly 20. Beyond her husband's, who we've mentioned, victims included, I'm just going to read a list. It's going to be short, but I just wanted to make sure that these people's names were said.
Yeah, I would have done the same if I could find the names.
I know. Okay. And it's not your fault. That pisses me off. Yeah. Because honestly,
like, we know her parents.
I really resent how killers gain more notoriety than their victims. And I understand logically why it happens, but they're pieces of shit.
Right.
Fuck them. You know, the damage they caused wasn't just taking the life, but taking the entire future and all possible interactions and benefits because they killed another human being.
Right.
So Stanley Zakruski, her cousin, who died in 1912 at 16 years old. Stella Zakruski, her cousin, who died in 1913 at 23 years old.
Wait, is that the cousin she was bitching to? Oh, no, that was the one.
That's Nellie. Yeah. Yep, she comes back. Helen Zakruski, her cousin, Jesus, who died in 1915. I tried to organize these as chronologically as possible to give a scale of how frequently she was killing, or at least trying to kill. So Helen died at 15 years old, and allegedly Tilly cared for all three of these cousins when they were ill. Jesus Christ. So that leads me to believe either they were ill and then she preyed on that, or she was caring for them while she was simultaneously killing them. Which then, I don't know, it just makes me think of her, like, making that hat next to Frank's bedside and taunting him.
Oh, yeah.
I just, I'm like, she's gross. Sadistic. She's sadistic. Sophie Strumer, Nellie Kulick's daughter, who died in 1917. I couldn't find the age. Ben Strumer, who was Sophie's twin brother, who died just a month after Sophie. So these two twins died within a month of each other. Again, I couldn't find the age. Wojciech Strumer, Nellie's husband, who died in 1918, so just a year after the twins, and he was confirmed to have died from arsenic poisoning. So we know that was a murder.
Yep.
John Strumer, Nellie's son, who fell sick shortly after his father died, but he recovered. Good. So he did not die. Dorothy Spira, Nellie Kulick's granddaughter, who died at only 2 years old.
And Nellie's the cousin, right?
Nellie is the cousin who allegedly provided Tilly with the arsenic. Yep. Yeah. So just, again, keep Nellie in the back of your head. Lillian Strumer, Nellie's daughter, who fell ill at 13 after living with Tilly. She survived but did suffer long-term effects from her quote-unquote illness.
Yeah, no, that's how it happened with a lot of Maria's victims. The ones who didn't die suffered long-term effects.
Mrs. Rose Chudzinski, her cousin, so Tilly's cousin, who died in 1919 after attending Tilly and Frank's wedding. Gross.
Yeah.
Mrs. Rose Split, a woman that so Joseph Klimek had allegedly flirted with, or at least had, like, spoken to at some point. It's really up for debate as to what that kind of interaction was, because it sounds like Tilly was a jealous bitch. She became sick after Tilly gave her candy, but she did recover. So as you may have noticed, many of Nellie Kulick's relatives, including her husband, children, and grandchildren, were also killed. And this lent a lot of credence to Tilly's claims that Nellie had been the one that supplied her with arsenic. Or perhaps had also been killing alongside her.
Yeah.
So when Nellie's husband, Wojciech Strumer, was exhumed, it was found that his body contained lethal levels of arsenic. So he was confirmed to have been murdered. Whether it was by Tilly or Nellie,
unknown.
I don't think we're ever going to know. Personally, I find Nellie quite sus.
Right.
But we'll find out how her story pans out. So both women were tried for murder and spent a year in jail awaiting/during the trial. Couldn't quite figure out. While in jail together, Tilly relentlessly taunted Nellie, telling her, Tilly's a fucking bitch. She is the worst. So she's taunting Nellie, saying, "Ooh, they're going to hang you today, Nellie." And then sometimes she would whisper to Nellie in Polish. And though the guards couldn't understand what Tilly was saying, Nellie would scream in terror in response. You know, it wasn't like, "Love ya."
Right.
Or anything positive. It was probably like, "You're going to die." Like just something really awful. So the idea that two women were colluding in a murder scheme led to reports that perhaps this wasn't just an isolated operation, but that Tilly was actually the, quote, high priestess of the Bluebeard clique. Don't ask me what the fuck a Bluebeard clique is. I literally have that written in my notes. Don't ask me what the fuck that is. I couldn't find it. I Googled Bluebeard clique, and all that came up were articles about Tilly. And it just had that same quote.
Yeah.
So basically, they're saying she's the high priestess of a murderous lady cult.
That, as far as we know, maybe includes one other person.
Exactly. But, you know, when it includes one other woman who you're not expecting to murder anyone, it could include countless women. And this actually caused panic among Little Poland, and more wives were arrested as suspected members of this murder cult.
Christ.
They were subsequently released, but still. Because they're like, oh, it can't just be like a woman doing this. It has to be this, which here's the thing. We talked about the Angels of Nagariv, and that was basically what they're fearing. So I'm not going to say they're crazy.
But
also give credence that one human being can be the worst.
Right.
Anyway, Tilly's courtroom outfit included the same black hat.
Oh my God.
That she had sewn next to Frank's bed as he lay dying. And that she wore to his funeral, and that she taunted him with. That just, I don't think he was the first or only person she did that with, but that, like, the fact that happened really fucks me. Can you imagine anyone?
That's just an extra level.
Anyone trying to take care of you, like, you're sick, you feel awful, and someone's like, yeah, you're going to die, and let me get my outfit ready.
Right. Let me just work on my outfit.
It's just, it's so unnecessary. It's so awful.
Let me go coffin shopping in this newspaper while you're still alive.
Let me show off this great deal on a coffin I found to everyone I know, including our landlady. Jesus, fuck her. I hate her so much.
Right.
So, and she's getting joy out of this. You know she got 100%. Off wearing that outfit. Anyway, prosecutors read the long list of alleged victims' names, asking after each one, did you kill this person? And in response, Tilly would shrug and reply, yeah. She had no fucks to give.
Wow. I'm actually surprised.
I think she kind of knew she was always going to get caught.
Still, and I'm surprised she admitted to it.
Yeah, I also read in places that she never admitted to it, so who knows, but she definitely did it. Just saying. So Tilly was unanimously found guilty on March of 1923. Though she could have been convicted of like 20 plus murder, she was only convicted of first degree murder of Frank Kuchick. The one that she had so relentlessly taunted. Because the husband after that survived. Mm-hmm. And even though the previous husbands were found to have lethal levels of arsenic, I think what probably happened is that they were able to definitively get her on this. And they're like, well, she's going away forever, so we don't need to get her on the others. Which, I don't know. Nail her to the wall for everything. Nail her to the wall for everything. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, which was the harshest sentence ever given to a woman in Chicago at the time. So.
I know they kill women at some point.
Actually, the judge was very pro-death penalty, but they, for some reason, decided just to do life in prison without the possibility of parole. That may have partially been because they're like, she's nuts. It may have been because she's a woman. It may have like been moral objection to the death penalty. Who knows? The now 45-year-old Tilly had no reaction except to remark, it was warm in there, as she was escorted out of the courtroom back to jail. She's like, wow, that courtroom was kind of toasty. Do you think they could have turned down the thermostat? Just saying.
Jesus Christ. She is
the worst. She's
psycho.
It gets worse. So when she arrived back in her cell, Nellie, who was still awaiting her own trial, so Nellie hasn't been tried yet, she rushed to the bars of Tilly's cell, asking her the results of her trial. Because obviously, they're being kind of tried for, like, the same thing. So Tilly's outcome is going to likely predict Nellie's. When Tilly coldly responded that she had been sentenced to life, and allegedly she responded in, like, 8 words in Polish, Nellie broke down in tears. So Tilly's like, Yeah, I got sentenced to life. Fuck you. You know, like, she doesn't care.
She doesn't care, yeah.
Nellie, on the other hand, loses her goddamn mind.
Right.
Nellie's trial, which started a week after Tilly's conviction, ended in a hung jury and then an acquittal.
Good.
Well, okay.
I don't know. It's hard to tell if Nellie actually did something or not.
I think one of two things happened. Either Nellie had nothing to do with it, or this was kind of a folly ado where Tilly was the leading actor in the situation. She was the sociopath. She was the one who didn't feel anything for killing these people.
And Nellie had
a sense of self-preservation and was following. It's just the numbers of people, Nellie's husband, her children, her grandchildren who were killed.
It also depends on, like, how close Nellie and Tilly were.
It does. It does. Because,
like, if they were hanging out all the time and Tilly's constantly giving Nellie food.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, no, because I do think Tilly was.
I think she got off on hurting people.
Well, no, for sure. But I think Tilly also got off on hurting people.
Right, like, because she was clearly, even if Nellie did do something, she was clearly, like, purposely scaring her in jail.
Yes, no, and I, like I said, if they were in it together, Tilly was definitely the leader of the duo. Nelly had a sense of self-preservation at the very least. It just, I can't ignore that her husband and all of her children, like, they were all murdered. Like, all those kids don't die so close together with the husband being definitively murdered without, you know, it's not an accident.
Know, so yeah.
I don't know about Nelly, but I don't, at the very least, I don't think she had the same, like, sociopathy that Tilly did, which is neither here nor there at the end of the day, but she was acquitted. Those are the facts. Tilly lived out the rest of her life in Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet. She died on November 3rd or 20th or 30th, depending on what source you read, sometime in November of 1936 at 60 years old, which is a lot more life than many of her victims got to live.
Right.
And she was buried in an unmarked grave in Bohemia National Cemetery in Chicago, Illinois, in Cook County.
That must have been like a thing to bury inmates in unmarked graves.
Well, prison graveyards are common, and it can be hard to find them. I don't know what Bohemian National Cemetery looks like today, but I couldn't find like a plot or site number. It kept saying unmarked grave. That was the only detail as far as to where she's buried that I could find.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That might have been a common prison practice.
Also, fuck her. I really
because
don't care.
A lot of times they didn't want people fucking with graves of inmates.
Yes.
So they would purposely bury them in unmarked graves for that reason.
And I tried to find at least everywhere that her victims were buried.
Right.
That
those
I could.
Are the important ones.
Fuck her. So one question personally still lingers for me. How was Tilly convicted, but Nelly, who arguably had more direct relatives die than Tilly, get acquitted? And I think a huge part of that is due to Tilly's lack of emotion or remorse, but it's also worth noting that Nelly was younger and prettier, while Tilly was characterized in newspaper articles as old, squat, unattractive, who would fucking marry her? So during this time, kind of like we touched on with our references to the Chicago musical, Chicago was having a love affair with beautiful femme fatales. And more often than not, the attractive murderesses would get off or have even lighter sentences, while the unattractive ones were convicted or received harsher sentences. This is not to say Tilly didn't deserve to be put away for the rest of her life, because she definitely did. But I think it's worth noting, because this is a women's history podcast, we're constantly talking about feminist issues. I think it's interesting how even when a woman kills, even when she has definitively taken the life of another person, so much comes down to, how does she look?
Right. What does she look like? Is she pretty?
Especially, how does she look in court? And I didn't include the quotes because the story already ran a little long, but there was a lot of description about how she looked. And we come across that in a lot of our stories. But when it comes down to someone who has taken the life of another human being,
it doesn't matter.
Except for that funeral hat. That's telling.
Right.
But like,
the rest of it doesn't matter.
She's old and fat and short. Like, that literally has no bearing into what she has done to other people and the lives that she has destroyed. And that is the frustrating story of Tilly Klimek, the killer clairvoyant.
Yeah.
I also saw in several articles where she was described as like the most notable or infamous serial killer in Chicago, which I would say I would disagree with that.
Depends on the metric you use.
Well, I would disagree with that, because honestly, H.H. Holmes, just as far as notoriety, is way more
well-known.
Well, and he's
on,
more
it
like
depends on
fucked.
Are you saying like female?
She was
just in general.
It just said serial killer. It didn't discriminate based on gender. But remember, Chicago also had H.H. Holmes and John Wayne Gacy. So,
well, John Wayne Gacy was all over Illinois. I didn't think he was only in Chicago.
He was just outside of Chicago, and he preyed on. Chicago was his hunting grounds. He would bring boys back from Chicago and the Chicago area.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people don't consider him like a Chicago
I think killer. It depends on if you live in Chicago or not.
That's true.
Anyway, California.
H.H. Holmes was other cities, but also Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. He has Murder Castle in Chicago at the World's Fair. Yeah, and that was
the big one.
That's what he's most noted for. He was also.
It's still around.
He was it got torn down as a post office now.
All right.
I know these things. I know nothing else, but I know this. But he was another killer. He was very sadistic, but also he was very results driven in the fact that he killed for like money and insurance and property.
How many people are they saying she killed?
Oh God, around like 20 or so.
Yeah, and that's not including animals. John Wayne Gacy was 33.
So
minimum.
I don't know if I call her the most prolific, but she's probably the most prolific Chicago killer you've never heard of.
Yeah. Maybe most prolific female Chicago serial killer.
For sure. But yeah, no, I mean, it's this, we see this a lot in female killers, the results driven, you know, life insurance money, trying like, or exploiting people to gain something.
Right.
But she also clearly had this joy, this sadistic pleasure that she got out of it. And I don't know, that little insight that we get with Frank
dying.
It's
so creepy.
It's, like,
that just adds a whole other level.
Yeah, no.
Like, she was literally taunting him.
Yeah, as she was killing him. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, that's Tilly Klimek, the killer clairvoyant. I think we all need something to make ourselves feel a little better. Kelly, my love. My darling, my Taco Bell buddy, what are you thankful for?
That's a good question.
After
whenever
all of this.
Whenever we do two in a row, I'm always like,
I know, yeah, but I feel like I blew my load.
But then after a story like that, I'm like, everything. I am thankful for everything. I'm thankful that my husband is not a murderous sociopath. I'm thankful that my podcast co-host is not a murderous sociopath.
I mean, I need you alive either way, so.
Right. It, like, makes me want to take down the sign in my kitchen.
Oh, many have eaten here, few have died. Well, and yeah, Tilly was delivering. Tilly exactly. And Maria were delivering their arsenic primarily through food because, again, that's expected women to feed and nourish. Okay. So no one's going to question what they're feeding them.
I don't keep rat poison in my house because I can't use rat poison because I have dogs.
So when I did have a problem with mice, which has stopped since Arthur has come along. I know. I used live traps because I couldn't deal with killing. I can kill insects, but anything mammalian or bigger, yeah. I can't do it.
No, we've never
it
had
fucks
mice,
me up.
But that's how I would have done it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I don't keep, even for ants, I don't keep like, there's like something, it looks like honey.
Yeah.
And I won't use that because I'm like, my dogs could get into it and then they would die.
Yeah.
So I use stuff that they take back to their nest versus them like dying in my house and then my dog's eating poisoned ants.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that just shows you the spectrum of caring for other living things that exists. These people killed other human beings. You and I don't even want to like a mouse that is argued like totally fair game. We don't want them in our house. They're fucking shit up. They're a nuisance. We don't even want to hurt them because that just feels mean.
Yeah.
I'm thankful that I'm not a piece of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
In this way. I'm a piece of shit in other ways, but like they're charming and like I'm growing as
people
a person.
Can deal with them.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God, you're so human and relatable because you don't have your shit together. I like that. That's my brand.
That's our brand.
That's our brand.
It's the whiny about her story.
Trash queens and raccoons love us.
Yeah. What are you thankful for?
Oh shit.
Besides not being a trash person.
Well, I'm thankful. One of my good friends is having her baby shower for her second child.
Yay.
And I'm really excited that she's including me, you know, in the baby shower and like other things, but also she's asking for the help that I've continuously offered over like the 8 years of her oldest child's life. But she's accepting that. And her oldest child is 8 years old, and that's a pretty, you know, it's a significant age gap, and she's been the only child for quite a long time. And so I checked in with my friend to make sure this was okay, and I had it greenlit by her, but I made some coupons for her oldest child for like outings, like ice cream outing, a movie.
With you or with your parents?
With me. Like dinner at a restaurant of your choice, because then that gives her mom a break with the baby, who is arguably much more needy.
But then it gives the kid homebound time, like one-on-one gives, time with someone.
But then it gives the kid, yeah, that one-on-one time that she's not going to get anymore. But I'm thankful to be
Emily time.
I get to be Auntie Em. But I'm thankful that she is, you know, willing to include me in her life and her kids' lives. She told me, like, I'm the emergency contact for her new baby. And I was like, aww. Oh, my God, what? I'm not crying. You're crying. I also got to go shopping with a friend of ours for baby shit. And I just finished watching The Mandalorian with Mafella. Baby Yoda. Okay, I know I'm so late for the train. Like, the train has come and gone and come and gone again. But I just finished watching it, and I was like, Baby Yoda is, like, the cutest thing, and the sounds I was making were not human. So I got a bunch of Baby Yoda shit and some dinosaur outfits for this little boy, and I'm so excited. I'm like, I'm going to push all of my interests on you. Because you're an infant, and you get no choice right now.
Right. At least for the first, like, maybe 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, like, you're gonna have some dinosaur shit, buddy. That's just your life right now. Deal with it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm excited for that. I'm excited to meet her son. I'm excited to be there for them, and just to help out in any way I can as a blissfully childless adult with a flexible job.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I'm very thankful to go to Target and just go ape shit in the baby section.
I know. Like, I realize that, like, we're going to have to see our new nephew tomorrow, and I'm like, I don't have anything. I'm like, I'm gonna have to, like, go to Target or something.
Oh my God. It was so much fun going with a friend, because normally when I shop for baby stuff in Target, I look like a lunatic because I'm running all over and I'm, like, taking shirts and, like, comparing them with leggings. I'm like, oh, but these have glitter, but does the glitter, like, shed? And, like, oh, my God, but this is on sale. Like, and I look insane, particularly for someone who is not accompanied by a child. So being able to talk through my insanity with another person was very helpful. So, thanks, Jory, friend of the podcast. Love you. She also got some, like, super cute stuff for the baby, and I'm excited. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. Like us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHPod.
Twitter at WAH_pod. Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com, where we would love to hear from you. Our merch is also available on our website, as well as we have a Patreon where you can donate for as little as $1 to get some extra content.
Also, rate us 5 stars wherever you listen. We have some really lovely 5-star reviews. Apparently, we're bingeable. #blessed. Oh, I hate myself a little. But yeah, definitely, like, if this is your first episode, maybe go back to, like, episode 3. Don't listen to episodes 1 and 2. We've actually thought about redoing those stories because the audio quality is so wretched, but it'll be a future thing.
I remember recording those.
I do too. I remember it so vividly. And
your kitchen.
And I well, the first one we did in my kitchen. No, wait.
One of them was in your kitchen.
One of them was in my kitchen. And then we re-recorded our first episode here. But it still sounded like shit.
Yeah, because we didn't have the better mics or
That's
anything.
That's right.
Yet.
Oh, God. We've come a long way in the past 3 years. You know, it's all about growth. It's all about trying to be a little better than you were yesterday. And we're definitely just a smidgeny bit better than we were yesterday. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And have an empowered day.
Bye!
Spooky witches.